flu has been around for decades, but the U.S. just had its first human death from the virus last week. A Louisiana man who became infected after exposure to a backyard flock and wild birds. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. So how worried should we be about the H5N1 virus? And what can we do to protect ourselves and prevent infection? Joining me now to talk about that and answer lots of other questions is University of Cincinnati Vice Chair for Clinical Research for Internal Medicine, Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. Welcome back, Dr. Fichtenbaum.
Thank you, Lucy. Thanks for having me back on.
Always great to have you. UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Dr. Fichtenbaum, the United States, as I mentioned, reported its first human death from the bird flu just last week. How worried should we all be about this?
Well, I think at this point there's always concern, but we have been monitoring these kinds of bird flus for a while, and what we're not seeing is human-to-human transmission. So I think right now, what we're worried about the most are coming in contact with animals, because the particular type of influenza A that we're seeing in these animal populations is very widespread in poultry, birds, and also cattle now.
Well, and you mentioned at this point the virus isn't transmissible from person to person, but how close are we to getting to that point? These viruses can mutate and cause problems, can't they?
Yeah, they can. I mean, we have seen this over many, many centuries. Many of the pandemics, like the 1918 Spanish influenza, 1957, we had another pandemic as well. And these were all mutations of viruses of influenza A that had the ability to spread human to human. We've seen these avian flu, these bird flu viruses, since the mid-1990s, but they have yet to really take hold. And what we know from scientific experiments is sometimes a single mutation can make the virus more likely to spread from person to person. But there's a but. The but is that a lot of times the mutation that happens may not be favorable to that virus. And so another mutation sometimes is required to sort of counterbalance that. And it's really important to the virus's survival, the order in which these mutations happen. So it is really hard for us to predict, even though a single mutation may make the difference. It's hard for us to predict if this can really happen in nature and will it take hold.
We're talking about bird flu. Do you have questions about protecting yourself and your family from the virus? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. You mentioned bird flu is not new, and there were major concerns during the George W. Bush administration.
There is no pandemic flu in our country or in the world at this time. But if we wait for a pandemic to appear, it will be too late to prepare. And one day, many lives could be needlessly lost because we failed to act today. By preparing now, we can give our citizens some peace of mind, knowing that our nation is ready to act at the first sign of danger.
How long has bird flu been on our radar? Did you say it's been since the 1990s?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of outbreaks in Guangdong, China, and in Hong Kong. And the part that I think concerned people the most was that there were the rates of people dying were anywhere between 30 to 50% with this particular avian influenza or bird flu. It was related directly to contact with poultry. And you may remember, or some of your audience may remember, that there were a lot of culling of birds at that time. And many of the chickens were no longer sent outside the countries in which the avian influenza was found. So we've seen it since then, but we've known about avian influenza since the 1800s. And we have good genetic data dating back to that time. Influenza has been around probably for thousands and thousands of years, and from time to time we see alterations that cause human epidemics and human pandemics, and they're just not that common, but they do happen.
Well, let's talk more about that. Has the virus been behaving differently in the U.S. in recent weeks? Is it behaving in a way that should make us concerned?
Well, I think there's a combination of things. One is there is a heightened awareness of this. And so since 2022, we've been testing very extensively in animal populations looking for this, what we call H5N1 avian influenza A. And since we've been doing that, there's also been surveillance that's been done by the CDC as well, looking for these infections in human beings. So the CDC has been sometimes doing surveillance of people who've been in contact with animals. And then, of course, reporting is really important. So they require physicians and healthcare providers and institutions to report any human cases. Most of these human cases have been very, very mild, conjunctivitis, sometimes mild flu symptoms. And we've also noticed that there may be people who've been exposed who have no reported symptoms but develop antibodies, suggesting there may be an asymptomatic infection as well. But I think the scary part for people are, one individual in Canada was infected for a long time and had a very severe illness there, as well as another individual in Louisiana who recently passed away. All of these individuals have had some type of contact with animals leading to this infection, and there has not been human-to-human transmission as yet.
I think the big worry for many people is, could this become the next pandemic? I mean, it feels like we just kind of got past the scariest part of the COVID pandemic. Could this be next?
I think that is always a concern. And I think one of the things that the CDC and others have recognized for a while is it has been really important for us to develop what we call pandemic preparedness, which is how do we respond to a situation? How do we know that something is possible? And how do we look for it so that at the earliest signs, we can make an intervention or give our best guess on how to prevent or adjust to a pandemic. I think everybody is a little bit shell-shocked and in a little having a little bit of PTSD with COVID-19 as well, because that was a pandemic that was not clearly predicted, and it came all of a sudden, and it had far-reaching consequences. So I think that as we think about when is the next pandemic going to occur, people have a lot of worry in their minds about how this might affect them, both individually and also their health as well. So I think it's important that we look for these things, Lucy, but I don't think we should be panicking about them. I think we should be collecting information, doing scientific studies, and also explaining to the public that we don't have the technology and tools yet in science that we can have an exact prediction saying on, February the 15th, 2025, there will be a pandemic of X or something like that. In science, we just don't have that ability. So I think the public has to understand that there may be lots of discussion and back and forth, and we may understand mechanisms of how something could become a pandemic, but we don't have the exact tools or abilities in 2025 to really predict them with certainty.
Sounds like it's even harder to predict than the weather, huh?
I think so. Yeah, I think I'm a little envious of the ability for us to predict hurricanes. I think I look at this a little bit more like earthquakes, where we're not really well situated technologically to say, hey, folks, there's going to be an earthquake. You're going to feel this in the next, 2 days. So we're in the same boat with them.
We're talking about bird flu. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did just get an email from Janelle, who writes, "Can you either debunk or verify a statement from my family member? She believes that one is more likely to get bird flu from organic or free-range eggs and chicken products. I maintain that the difference is negligible. Which is closer to the truth?" Do you have thoughts on that, Dr. Fichtenbaum?
Yeah, can you read that one again? I'm sorry. I think I got lost in the middle of that.
Oh, sure. No
Try
problem.
One more time.
The question is, Janelle has a family member who believes that someone is more likely to get bird flu from organic or free-range eggs and chicken products. Janelle doesn't buy it.
Yeah, no, I think it really depends on the location of the poultry and usually it's their contact with wild birds, such as geese and other birds that may be infected. So it really is quite variable. And I don't think you can put a blanket statement on it. So I don't think that I would say organic or other things are more likely to be infected with that. And we haven't seen infections from people, getting eggs and doing things like that. It's mostly been from the people who actually work caring for the animals or have close contact. Yeah, you're feeding animals, feeding birds, things like that. So I don't think it's a situation where if you go to a store and buy something that is organic, that you're going to be more likely to catch bird flu.
How tough is it for people to catch H5N1 at this point? Is it pretty? Do you have to have a lot of that close contact you just talked about?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the CDC is reporting, because when they've done surveillance studies, they've surveilled more than 11,000 people. And really, there's, only 63 cases right now that we know of to date. And so it's really hard. It looks like you have to have a lot of contact, and that contact has to involve, animals that are infected. We know that it can be both airborne and droplet and close contact. So, the CDC has recommendations for, wearing gloves, washing your hands, and then not touching your eyes, nose, and face after you've been in contact with animals. And there are surveillance systems in place for looking at animals as well to see whether flocks are infected, because obviously if you have a flock of poultry that's infected, or you have a herd of cattle that's infected, then you have to be really careful. But the important thing to understand about this virus is that it's kind of like a unique key to a car. You have a particular car, and you can't just take your key and put it in my car, Lucy, and try and start my car. It just doesn't work that way. In the same way, the H5N1 viruses, they have a very unique signature that only allows them to really go in birds or in cattle, but they cannot attach to the locks that we have in our respiratory system and really link into human beings. Now, we've seen these occasional cases, but we really haven't seen the mutations necessary to make it sustainable, and in particular for it to really grow quickly in humans and then be spread from human to human.
Okay. Well, we're going to continue our conversation after a short break, and later in the program, we'll hear about the complex legal legacy of the first Ohioan to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about bird flu. My guest is University of Cincinnati Vice Chair for Clinical Research for Internal Medicine, Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk@wvxu.org. Before the break, Dr. Fichtenbaum, you mentioned cattle, and here in the U.S., bird flu breached cattle in Texas last year. Is there more you think the government could have done at that point to contain it? I mean, it seems like the presence of the virus in cattle has had meant a lot more humans have contracted it.
Yeah, I mean, I think once we find it, it's probably been there in many, many places. So it's kind of like the situation that we just identify it. And it's really expensive to be doing testing for influenza. You know, we test for many different types of important infections in animals so that we avoid human contact and contamination. So, you know, it's really hard. And once you find it, I think it's probably been there. So we're seeing it in 14 states now in cattle. So it's quite widespread. You know, this is not something we're seeing in our, you know, domestic animals. So it's not like dogs, cats, and our local pets, you know, we're seeing this influenza. So we don't have to worry about this strain becoming the cat's meow.
Oh, wow. You went there. Now, we've known each other for a long time now. I know you brought up cats because I'm a self-identified crazy cat lady. I thought I had read that there were some cats who had contracted this by messing with wild birds. Is that not right?
It is. It is true. But it's not something we've seen with humans.
Okay. Gotcha. You're not going to get it from your cat if your cat gets sick from messing with a bird.
Right.
Okay. Okay. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Patricia. Thanks so much for your call. What's your question?
I'm interested in knowing if there's been any information about wild flocks of birds coming in, particularly starlings that come in great numbers to our bird feeders, particularly in this extremely cold weather with snow on the ground. They create quite a lot of droppings. When you go out to refresh your feeders, they're flying all around. I'm just wondering, what is anybody tracking that or studying that, or what is the risk for contagion, perhaps, because they are migrating flocks?
Thank you so much, Patricia. What about that, Dr. Fichtenbaum?
Yeah, so I think there has been some study of, and it's mostly been wild waterfowl. So I'm not sure that there has been study in necessarily everyone, but I would recommend going to the CDC website because they have very nice information on avian influenza in a variety of species. So if you look, that it's been identified in 100 different wild birds around the world, and it's mostly ones the wild aquatic birds and ducks and of course chickens and turkeys and things like that. I think it's been a little bit different than what we're seeing, for example, with West Nile virus and crows. So I'm not certain that we're seeing it in, you know, every species of bird like sparrows and things like that. So I think obviously the safest thing is to be very careful around bird droppings in general and make sure that you're, you know, cleaning things up. And if you happen to have a little surgical mask on hand when you're cleaning things up, that'll prevent aerosolization of any kind of infection that might happen. I think the other place you could check is the Ohio Department of Health to see if they're doing testing on any of our local birds. I'm not aware of that at all.
Okay. Thanks so much for that question, Patricia, and thanks for listening. What about protection, prevention for people? Do annual flu vaccinations provide any protection, Dr. Fichtenbaum, or are there bird flu specific vaccinations people can get?
Yeah, so obviously we are working on a variety of different vaccines. One of the problems we've had with influenza vaccination is it has to be very specific to two different really important proteins. One is called the hemagglutinin and the other one is called the neuraminidase. These are very important proteins that help the virus either attach and invade human beings. And they vary from strain to strain, from species to species. And so it's very hard for us to build vaccines that generate immunity against all of these different types, especially when they're shifting all around. We are working on that. And there is some immunity, and there's a recent study that hasn't really been officially published, but there's a pre-publication of it that showed that more recent vaccinations for influenza seasonal vaccines confer a little bit of protection, but not very much, only about 15% protection. And it doesn't look like people who've been infected in the past with influenza have much protection from these new H5N1 strains when we look at this in the laboratory. So we will need to develop specific vaccines, and people are working on those. The other thing is that it does appear that our antiviral agents that we use to treat influenza, like something called oseltamivir, do have some effectiveness against that. So that would be something that would be helpful. So we still have work to do to really produce good protection against these new strains of influenza.
What else should we be doing to protect ourselves? Patricia just asked about, you know, having bird feeders. Do you think that's okay? There are people who will pick up baby birds that they see, you know, having fallen from nests. I mean, people do have contact with birds. And even, you know, I've read about the problems related to drinking raw milk or eating raw cheese. What should we be thinking about along all those lines?
Yeah, I think that if you're going to come in contact with wild animals, that the safest thing to do is if you can be wearing gloves. And again, if you're around droppings and things, if you're wearing a mask, when you've completed your contact with the animal, make sure that you wash your hands carefully. Remember to sing the happy birthday song twice. That means that you're doing 30 seconds of washing your hands. Make sure you're not touching your eyes, nose, and face when you're handling any wild animals. And then make sure that you've washed after you've done that, of course. I think those are the best ways to protect ourselves. I don't think at this point in time that we would be advising people don't do the kinds of things that you're doing, such as having bird feeders, because there's really not evidence that our local birds are really the ones that are responsible for the transmission of this new H5N1, what we call highly pathogenic influenza.
Last month, the Ohio Department of Agriculture did confirm that bird flu was detected, and I think it was nearly 1 million chickens in Dark County, Ohio. What are the implications of that, if any?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like any other state that we're seeing, which the poultry populations have been widely infected for a number of years. And now we're seeing our cattle populations rise with this. I think it just means that, you know, it's really, really hard for us to prevent transmission from animals because we see so much movement of animals from farm to farm, and also I think there's contact with wild birds and things like that in poultry farms as well. I think we've seen that. So it just tells us it's here and it's not a surprise. And I think that we should be monitoring the situation in all of the livestock that we have in Ohio.
We're about to have a change in presidential administrations and a change in leadership at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. What are the implications of that when it comes to research on viruses like this?
Well, I think it's really, really important that we continue to support scientific investigation, because one of the things that has made us a leader in health discovery and research has been our ability to invest in our own research engine to develop new treatments, new things to help cure cancer, new things to treat heart disease, new things to treat infections. So I think it would be unwise for us to stop supporting that kind of research engine, because it's made a difference in, you know, human ability to grapple with disease and to deal with real problems that we know we need to solve. And I'm always confident, I take the optimistic view that, you know, any new administration's going to weigh the evidence and continue to support important research developments in a wide variety of areas, including infectious diseases, which can affect the public.
What are the takeaways from the U.S. response to the COVID pandemic? How prepared do you think we are nationally for this virus or whatever the next pandemic might be?
Well, I'll try to answer this one quickly, because that's really a long answer. But I think we did some good things, and I think we made a lot of mistakes. I think that's sort of normal with human beings. Every time we're faced with a very crisis situation, it becomes a real challenge for us to look back in time, look at our history, calmly address a problem, and try to develop a strategy that we think is going to work the best. And there will always be people that criticize the way you approach something. And the problem we have for most of these major issues like a pandemic like COVID-19 is we can't try it this way, that way, and the other way. We have to go one direction, and there will always be people who in hindsight will second guess how we did things.
That makes sense. What about locally? Do you feel like we're prepared locally if something big were to hit in the future?
Well, I think that we showed during the COVID-19 pandemic that healthcare systems were able to partner with the health department, and we were able to create fairly rapidly very important connections that allowed us to inform the public, to create systems to make sure people could get vaccinated, people could get tested. I think we could do much better in our public health system, because we're reliant upon many different health systems really coming together. We did that, and I think it shows we can, but I think it would be good if we developed better systems to make this even smoother.
Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Vice Chair for Clinical Research for Internal Medicine, Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, the complex legal legacy of the first Ohioan to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Cincinnati Edition.